Holy God, holy and most gracious Father.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana at issuesetc.org. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel, live weekday mornings, 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific. issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We all know the experience if you're a regular attender at Bible class at church or during the middle of the week. You know what it's like. You sit around. Everybody speaks the same language, right? We're all speaking English here in America for the most part. And we have the translations in front of us. Everybody carries their own Bible. And they're all in the same language. It's not like one is in Chinese and the other one is in Portuguese and there's another one in English. We're not dealing with that kind of language problem. We are dealing with translations that are all the same language, and yet the translations aren't all the same. And they are coming, we are told, from the same documents, Bible translations. How can it be that translation of the same documents into the same language can be different? As different as English translations are, and a little bit later we'll be talking with Dr. Cameron McKenzie about those documents from which these translations are made. Joining us to talk about Bible translations on this Wednesday afternoon, November the 5th, Dr. Cameron McKenzie, professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored an article in the latest For the Life of the World magazine titled The Text of the Bible, Where Did It Come From? Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Pleased to be with you and your listeners today.
So we've got the average Bible class of about 20 people there, maybe 5 different Bible translations between the 20 of them, and they're all in the same language, English. How do we account for the differences between English translations of the very same Bible?
Sure. Well, the various translations are done by different groups of people, maybe individuals, usually these days by committees. They have different philosophies of translation, that is, how one goes about his work. They have different English styles. They have different sort of thoughts on kind of the best vocabulary and usage. And then they even differ as to what they're translating, what manuscripts they're actually looking at, or what texts they're actually looking at. So you put it together, and you get lots of variety, for sure.
Now, usually they read together very nicely. I mean, it's not as though one Bible, English Bible translation, is going to have the virgin birth and the other one isn't going to have it.
Right.
I mean, they're going to convey the same facts. How would you talk about the – and we're talking here about solid translations, not paraphrases or anything like that. How would you how would you account for the differences between those two? They're conveying the same facts, but sometimes the language is different. Is it only – are there theological differences in some translations that we should be aware of?
There can be, for sure. But they're going to differ – those of your listeners who know two languages will know exactly what I'm talking about. Those who don't know two languages may find this a little confusing. But if you think about a dictionary, there's an English word, let's just say the word, and you look it up in the dictionary, it might have 5 different meanings. That means that when you go to translate that word, you have at least 5 different ways that you could do it. Well, the same thing is true in foreign languages. So the words permit different choices in English, and translators make those different choices. Guided by what kind of style they want the English to be in, what kind of philosophy they have of translating, and then also, to one degree or another, what their theology is. For example, in the Reformation time, there was a great debate between Catholic translators and Protestant translators about all of those issues, and so they would translate the same, well, they actually used different texts, but it was the same Bible, and come up with radically different translations, really on account of theological commitments more than anything else. A good kind of modern example is it's more a cultural convention, but it has certain theological overtones, is the whole issue of feminist language, sometimes called inclusive language, where translators are committed to an English Bible that accommodates feminist usage. So, for example, translations that traditionally would translate a Greek word as brother, because that's usually the way it's translated, now you find in modern translations the phrase brother or sisters, or a word that in the Hebrew meant fathers will now be translated ancestors or parents. Well, those are choices that are dictated really by ideology, or let's say social conventions, rather than concerns for strict accuracy of the sort that might have characterized other Bible translations.
An honest accounting in an English translation, how important is that, Dr. McKenzie? And that is, I guess what I'm asking is, and any casual student of English translations will have seen this. They'll see mm-hmm. the text up there. There may be a tiny footnote or marker there, and at the bottom they might find in that little footnote where it says brothers and sisters, the footnote right. will indicate right. original says brothers. They're accounting for, the translators are accounting for something that they've added in there for ease of reading, or maybe even, as you said, for kind of philosophical theological reasons. But they're mm-hmm. accounting for it and letting the reader know that they've done something there. How important is that?
Well, I think it's better than nothing, but most people don't read the fine print in footnotes like that. And if something makes it into the text and is relegated to footnotes, that's a signal to the reader that the footnote is less important than what made it into the text. So I would say that's a good thing to do, but I think the choice that the translators make about what's actually going to go into the translation is the more important choice. And if there are patterns of choices like that in a translation, then the reader should be aware of what those patterns tell you about the translator's commitments in the first place.
So an extreme...
Let me give you an example. Now somewhat passé, but when the Revised Standard Version came out in New Testament 1940s, Old Testament I think it was 1952, it was informed by what today we might call just a higher critical view of the Scriptures. And that was particularly noticeable when it came to Old Testament prophecy, because in numerous instances, the Old Testament translators took a form of a translation of the Hebrew that would be difficult to match up with the way the New Testament understood those same verses. So, for example, St. Paul argues out of Genesis that God promised to Abraham, a blessing to Abraham and his seed, singular. And Paul talks about that, it's just one. And the Old Testament passage to which Paul is referring was the one that in the Old King James said, "In thy seed, singular, shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." Well, because they didn't want to, I mean, I'm not saying these people weren't Christians, but they had a different view of the Old Testament. And so they translated that passage in the Old Testament something like, "In your descendants," plural, "all the nations of the earth will bless themselves." So you couldn't really read that in the English Bible and figure out how St. Paul got it, got his argument in the New Testament. Well, that represented a kind of idea about what the Bible was in the first place that came to be reflected in the translation. The more famous example, of course, is Isaiah 7:14, which the evangelist Matthew cites as confirmation of the virgin birth. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. Well, the Revised Standard Version translated that in the Old Testament as, behold, a young woman shall conceive and have a son. So again, it's not like they took the virgin birth out of the New Testament, but how do you show that that Matthew was actually translating or citing accurately what Isaiah had said in the Old Testament? So this kind of philosophical or theological or cultural commitment, whatever you want to call it, does affect or can affect the way that the translation comes out in the end.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. We're talking about Bible translations on this Wednesday afternoon, November the 5th. He is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Well, as he says, there's a further wrinkle here, and that is that there is some debate over what the original text, both in Hebrew and Greek, ought to be. We'll talk about that and really answer the question by the end, is your Bible translation reliable? Stay tuned. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Grace Lutheran, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Heritage Lutheran, Valparaiso, Indiana, Mount Olive Lutheran, Duluth, Minnesota, Our Savior's Lutheran, Windham, Minnesota, St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin, Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California, St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa, St. John Lutheran, Yuma, Colorado, Christ Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri, and Redeemer Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd, and thanks for everything you do.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on the value of Issues Etc.
You've done so much to teach so many people about the depth of the gospel and to find joy in the Christian life and experience.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, Issues Etc. Listen to what you want, when you want, at issuesetc.org.
Trinity Orchard Farm is settled between two rivers, showing the way to the water of life. For worship that is reverent, relevant, and refreshing like pure water, or for excellent education in a unique setting, check out our church and school. We're just 5 miles north of Highway 370 on Highway 94 in St. Charles County. Visit us on the web at trinityorchardfarm.com. That's trinityorchardfarm.com. Our phone number is 636-250-3350.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Bible translations with Dr. Cameron McKenzie, professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. That is a great place. I've been reminded of that because we just started running their live chapel service. It's a morning chapel from Kramer Chapel this week at our 24/7 Issues Etc. Best of station at issuesetc.org. And hearing the preaching, the chapel, the liturgy from there reminds me, as I've often heard from many of our guests from Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, when you go there to study to be either a pastor or a deaconess, the center of the life is not so much the classroom as it is the chapel. And that's the way a seminary ought to be. The classroom is there, but the chapel is the center of the life because the word and the sacraments are the center of the church's life. At Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they are forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Find out more about them on the web, ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or give them a call, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, let's add the wrinkle that we need to be honest about this, and that is, while there are debates and differences in English translations as to what the final translated product ought to say, there's a deeper debate, and that is over the original texts from which the translations are drawn. How would you describe that?
Yeah, well, I think maybe the easiest thing for many of our listeners would be to go back to the Reformation, and maybe they even remember this at a time. Well, if they've ever looked at a Catholic Bible and a Protestant Bible, they find that there's a tremendous amount in common, but there are seven additional books in the Catholic Old Testament that aren't present in the Protestant Old Testament. Those books are known as the Apocrypha. Now, where did they come from? Well, that's a question of what text you're translating for the Bible in the first place. At the time of the Reformation, Luther and other reformers argued that you ought to translate the Greek for the New Testament and the Hebrew for the Old Testament. Catholic position was, look, for centuries we've been using the Latin Bible, so let's stick with the Latin Bible instead of worrying about the Hebrew and the Greek. After all, the Hebrew was the Bible of the Jews who had rejected Christ, and the Greek was the Bible of the Greeks who, from the Catholic perspective, were a schismatic church. So in the Reformation, you had a very obvious debate between the two sides over what text you were going to translate when you approach the Bible in the first place. What's interesting about that argument is that it actually goes back to the days of the early church, and it was a point at which Jerome and Augustine argued with each other. And there, it wasn't Latin versus Greek. But the issue for the Old Testament was Hebrew versus Greek, because the Bible that the early church had used in many parts of the Greco-Roman world was the Greek version of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint. And that was kind of the standard Bible, and translations were made into Latin from that Greek version, from the Septuagint. Jerome said, hey, this has gotten us off track. We ought to be using the Hebrew. So you ended up with these two church fathers at odds with one another already in the 4th century over which text ought to be translated. In their case, it was Hebrew versus Greek. In the 16th century, it was Hebrew and Greek versus Latin. And since the 19th century, it has been an argument, oh, yes, we ought to do the Hebrew for the Old Testament, we ought to do the Greek for the New Testament, but which Hebrew should we use and which Greek should we use? The story here is fairly simple, that up until the era of the printing press, Bibles were copied by hand. And your listeners can imagine how difficult it would be to create a careful copy of the entire Bible. I mean, it just would be impossible not to make mistakes. But that means that the oldest versions of the Bible, which are all these handwritten copies up until the time of the printing press, all differ from one another, whether we're talking Latin or Greek or whatever. And so before we translate a single word, we have to sort through all those manuscripts and make decisions about which of those variations is actually the one that we ought to translate. In other words, is the one that was the original word written, let's say, by Matthew or Paul or any of the other sacred writers. So it's still an important question, and that can sometimes account for differences in the English Bibles that we actually have. Again, probably some of your listeners can remember the Old King James Version, or maybe some of them are using the New King James Version. But if you compare the Old King James or New King James with, let's say, the New International Version or the English Standard Version, you'll find out that there are some verses that are missing. If, for example, you take a look at the ending to the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6, verse 13, you find that it's not in. That verse is missing from the New International Version or the English Standard Version, even though it's in the King James and the New King James. Well, that's not because the translators were sloppy and missed a verse. It's rather because one group of translators thought that the Greek text included it, and another group of translators thought that the original Greek text did not, and that difference is a difference reflected in the various manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, from which we have to reconstruct the original Greek text of the New Testament.
With all that said, Dr. McKenzie,
I just want to say it's a complicated process, as you can imagine.
Obviously, but to kind of simplify for the sake of our listeners here in the last 30 seconds or so, does that mean I can't rely on my Bible? Does that mean that it's all kind of up in the air? About 30 seconds, Dr. McKenzie.
Okay, the answer is no, because God keeps his promises that he will preserve his word, and that's more important than any of the ways that we kind of mess it up. But secondly, even with these great varieties that we were talking about, the variations we were talking about before, all of the central teachings of the Christian religion can be established by these various Bibles. Some are better than others, but nonetheless, even the defective ones still present God's truth as we've come to know it and confess it.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored an article for the latest For the Life of the World magazine titled The Text of the Bible, Where Did It Come From? Dr. McKenzie, thanks for being our guest.
You're very welcome, Todd, and thank you for your kind words about the seminary. Really appreciate it.
As I mentioned before, you can listen to morning chapel services live from Kramer Chapel on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, every weekday morning at 9 Central at issuesetc.org. Just get up in the morning, 9 o'clock, ready for your morning chapel service from Kramer Chapel. Just go to issuesetc.org and you can listen live every weekday morning. When we come back, hour two of Issues Etc., we're going to spend with, well, first, Dr. Kim Riddleberger talking about the basis for the doctrine of the Trinity, and then Terry Mattingly, some important questions for religion polling and how the media reads it. That's hour two of Issues Etc. in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.